Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 270, and we're going to talk about a thing that I've not said good things about in the past. It is the three-way fridge, or the two-way fridge, or the absorption fridge. We're also going to talk about ways to extract yourself from sticky situations using rope or straps. A product review of a much maligned product that could actually be useful, and a tale from the road involving an easy way down and a hard way up. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you very much for joining me once again. I've been fighting with my computer all morning trying to get this to work, and here we are. If you're hearing this, it all worked, and that just goes to show, well, that computers are a pain in the butt. It's basically what it goes to show. But look, here's the deal. I happen to be somebody who owns a whole lot of refrigerators. I don't know why. It's not like I collect the things. I mean, I have a refrigerator in my condo, your standard side-by-side refrigerator. Yes, it's fancy. It does have ice cubes that come out of the door. Yes. But seriously, it's just a fridge. Okay, so I have that, right? And then in the Tiki Bago, which is a 72 Winnebago that has been completely converted into like a tiki bar thing. Go back a few episodes if you haven't heard of this before. It has a three-way fridge. I'll get into some definitions later. In the Airstream, it also has a three-way fridge. In the new truck camper, which is now the Wren camper, it has a three-way fridge. And you see a pattern here. There's a lot of three-way fridges out there. And in my van, which I still own, but is no longer my van, and that's a very sore subject, I have a 12-volt compressor fridge. And in my garage, I have two 12-volt compressor fridges that are just kind of sitting there. And in the NV200 that I built out, I had a 12-volt compressor fridge. And in the Scamp that I recently sold to the lovely Yogi, there was a three-way fridge. Did you see a pattern there? Well, the pattern is that things that were built by RV manufacturers all had three-way fridges, or sometimes two-way fridges, or, as they're more appropriately called, absorption fridges. Why the difference? Why don't people use these refrigerators that have been around forever in their builds? Because everything I built, I put a 12-volt compressor fridge in. And if you've built out your own van, I'm going to guess you also put a 12-volt compressor fridge in there. Now, before we get into this, let's have some quick definitions. There are four basic ways to cool things in your van. The first one is obvious. It's with ice. You have a cooler or an ice chest. And these were actually common in low-end RVs until, say the last 15 or 20 years. If you got a cheap pop-up camper, for example, it might have an ice box in it. And the idea was you'd buy a big block of ice and put that in there, and that would keep your food cold for the weekend. And it still will. I don't recommend coolers for van life because over time, they end up costing a whole lot more money. They add weight to your rig for no discernible purpose, and you've got this thing that takes up a lot of space, and half of that space is eaten up with ice. So they are not the best way for cooling, in my opinion. Then there are the thermoelectric coolers. These things look like miracles. They can look like a cooler, or they can look like a fridge. And you open it up, and it's just all space for food. And it promises you the world. It'll cool your food. It'll heat your food. And it's only $50. Why isn't everyone using these things? And it's because they're terrible. These things cool with a Peltier device, it's called. It's a solid state thing. Basically, you plug this thing in and one side gets hot and one side gets cold. It moves heat from one side to the other, basically, and that's why you can make it a heater or a cooler. You can reverse that. But they're terrible. They don't have thermostats. You can't set the temperature. In fridge mode, they're going to lower the temperature 30 degrees from whatever the temperature is inside your van. So if it's 70 in your van, it'll lower things to 40, which is probably okay. But if it's 100, because, you know, like the sun's out, it's going to lower things to 70 degrees, which is a rapid trip to food poisoning if that's what you're after. So, yeah, ignore those things. Those are only good if you're going to like keep some drinks cool while you're driving somewhere, you know, for a few hours. And they use a ton of power. So forget about those. Then we get into the two actual real candidates. Now the 12 volt compressor fridge, which is what I recommend for most cases and which is what I prefer to use, is exactly what it sounds like. It's a compressor fridge, which is how your fridge at home works. There is a compressor, it compresses gases. As those gases expand, they draw heat out of the cooling box and then they expel it out of a radiator fin set up in the back. And it creates the cycle where the box is cool and it produces heat out the side. The 12 volt ones are extremely efficient. Some of them have the legendary Danfoss compressor. It doesn't matter. Honestly, all the 12 volt compressor fridges are pretty good, and you can even get dual zone ones. Lots to talk about there. I highly recommend those. What I'm about to say does not go against those. But I think it's also important to bring up that there's another way of refrigerating that is still common and still popular, and it's perhaps unfairly maligned. And that is, it's got three different names, unfortunately, the three-way fridge, the two-way fridge, or the absorption fridge. This is the quote-unquote normal fridge that is in most RVs, although a lot of newer RVs are either putting in 12-volt compressor fridges or 120-volt compressor fridges. Obviously, if you're not in the U.S. or North America, this will be a different voltage, but you understand what I'm saying. Mains current or nominal 12-volt current, which is what most vehicles have. Why are they doing this? Simplicity. These are very simple. All you need is a robust battery, and then you can power one of these things. And with the new technology in 12-volt compressors and in batteries and in solar, this whole big cycle here, it is now actually more economical to put one of these in even brand new RVs. But what of the absorption fridge? Okay, these things work on a completely different but they don't have a compressor. That's the bottom line. These fridges don't have a compressor. They have a liquid, it's basically ammonia, that is in these things. And it does the same absorbing heat, rejecting heat process through a phase change that a compressor fridge does, but it does it differently. It does it without a compressor. It just does it through gravity, which is why, and you'll hear this all the time, absorption fridges always need to be level. It's a big advantage of compressor fridges over absorption fridges. If you park on a slope, like let's say you're going out to dinner and it's in San Francisco and it's very hilly and you've miraculously found a place to park and it's on a slope, your absorption fridge won't like that, and in fact it could actually damage itself. Whereas your compressor fridge would be just like, eh, whatever, and keep going. I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but you'll hear that a lot. That's why. So what's with the two-way, three-way thing? Well, all an absorption fridge needs to work is one thing, and it's not electricity. It's heat. All they care about is heat. Heat is what is needed to start that cycle. You heat a liquid up, the liquid rises, it takes heat out, cools, this whole process. That's what's needed. It's just heat. So it's very, very simple. There's no moving parts in an absorption fridge, except for, you know, the liquid and the gas that it becomes. And that's pretty cool. What's even cooler, and no pun intended, is that you can set the temperature. Now, it's not as precise. I've never seen an absorption fridge that has a dial that you can set it to like 37 degrees or anything like that. Any that do are lying. They don't work on a thermostat. You can just adjust the amount of cooling. That's it. So in the Airstream, where I have a fairly fancy three-way fridge, I can set the temperature to like low, medium, high, and medium high and medium low, and that's it, which is great. And in the older ones, you actually had this little metal tab you had to slide up and down some fins. So the three-way fridge can get its heat from 12 volts, 110 volts or 240 volts, depending where you are, or propane or butane or whatever you have is the gas in your vehicle. And that's great for boondockers. Think about it. You've got three different sources of energy to keep your food cold. Now, there's a caveat here. On 110 volts and on propane, you will have full cooling. But on 12 volts, the cooling is very limited. And basically, that's a maintenance mode where you are not actually going to cool anything at that temperature. You're just going to keep things cold. You would set it in 12 volts like while you were driving from place to place. Don't open the door. If you open the door and it's on 12-volt cooling, it's never going to recover that heat that you introduced by opening the door. A lot of people make this mistake. They're used to 12-volt compressor fridges, and they'll get into a three-way fridge, and they'll think, well, I'll just set it to 12 volts, and I don't have to worry about it. Well, if you set it to 12 volts, what will happen is it will kill your batteries in like an hour, and then it won't cool your food. They need more energy than that. They're also very efficient. If you set that thing on propane, it can use propane very, very sparingly. If you're smart, you don't open the fridge very often and stuff like that, it'll run on propane a very long time. And that is its huge advantage over 12-volt compressor fridges. If you are boondock, especially someplace where solar is not a great option for you, you have limited recharging, you can remove all your refrigeration from your power needs if it's running on propane. That's a big deal. It's also great because it acts as a backup. Most of these fridges, not all, have an auto backup feature. So like in the Winnebago and the Airstream, both of those fridges, and it's not the original Winnebago fridge, to be clear, probably 15 years old. If the power fails, it will automatically switch over to propane, which is great. I mean, that has saved me. I know the power went out on my Airstream for 10 hours last week, just a general power outage. I wasn't there. I have a melt detector in my freezer, and I can tell that it didn't freeze. And when I got there, I looked, and it was on propane. I was like, oh, yeah, the power went out. That is very, very cool. So we have a fridge here that's very simple, proven technology, very robust. These things last a really long time. I mean, the Scamp I had that is now Yogi's was built in 1993. It's the original fridge. And Yogi and I sat down and spent some time cleaning it all out because you have to clean out the orifices and the thermocouple of the propane area from time to time. And we did that. And so far as I know, it has run perfectly ever since. In fact, the challenge was getting the temperature to be set right so everything wouldn't freeze in there because it was cooling things so well. That's a long time for a refrigerator. I will challenge you to find a household refrigerator that will last 32 years and still keep working. So given that these things are reliable and robust and they use different fuels, they seem like the perfect thing to put in your van, don't they? Because we're always, you know, worried about power and boondocking and having redundancies and all that. So why aren't people putting these in their vans? Well, believe it or not, as simple as these things are, they're very complex to install. Think about it. You need 12-volt power. Okay, that makes sense. You need 110-volt power. So you have to find a way, unless you're going to always run it on propane, which is an option, you have to find a way to wire 110 volts to it, and that has to go to the proper circuit breaker box, all that stuff. No, you're not going to do it off an inverter because ultimately you're just killing the batteries more. So that's not an option. You actually could only do 110 volts in one of these fridges off of mains power. I honestly don't think it would make any sense to do it off an inverter, no matter how much battery power you have. And then you've got gas, and gas is tricky. Running gas lines to these things, you are supposed to use only copper fittings or copper brass. You're not supposed to use hoses, and you've got to be careful about them. And then you've got a flue where the exhaust gases go. This is on the outside of your rig. So you need two panels, both ventilated. You need a way for the air to go in and to go up and out. And then you have to insulate things very carefully so that this hot thing doesn't catch anything on fire. And it just ends up being very complicated. However, if you are jumping into this van life thing and you decided to buy an old converted van, an old RV or trailer or some kind of van that has one of these fridges in it, I'm not thinking you need to replace it. I mean, seriously, we have looked at replacing the fridge in the Airstream. We could certainly do it. The Airstream doesn't move very much at all. It could just be a 110-volt fridge in there. It'd probably be more efficient, in fact. But the thing's fine. We've used it now for years. The one in the Tiki Bago has been going strong for 15 years. They just work. And that robustness of being able to use several fuels is worth a lot. So, if you are building out your own brand new van, get a 12-volt compressor fridge. It is the proper thing at this time. But don't just discard these other ones as old, you know? They're pretty cool. They are a very, very clever thing, well-suited to what we're doing. And if yours is working, I think your best bet is, honestly, just to leave it alone. And a special thank you to everyone who donates every month at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. Because of you, there are no ads in this podcast. And if you would like to help out, feel free to visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. And you may buy me a gallon or 2 or whatever of anything you'd like. And that will drive those nasty ads away. Thank you, everyone. Tech Talk. Okay, there are some crazy things on YouTube. You have probably noticed this. If you have looked at YouTube at all, there's some crazy stuff on there. One of the crazy topics you can delve into in YouTube is auto recovery. And auto has a few meanings there. In this case, I'm talking about people who get their vehicle stuck in the mud or whatever and then come up with, shall we say, creative ways of getting themselves unstuck. Now, there are many, many ways to get yourself unstuck from the mud. You start by rocking the vehicle. You can put your floor mats under the wheels. There's a whole bunch of things you can do. I want to talk about one specifically that is, shall we say, aggressive. If you've ever seen a winch and how a winch works, it's basically a drum, a horizontal drum, with a cable that wraps around it. You apply power to the drum, and it slowly rotates and winds up that cable with a lot of torque, and that cable gets tight, and then it starts to pull, and it pulls your vehicle out. And in most cases, you actually don't need to pull all that much. It just adds a little bit of forward movement, and then your wheels can take over from there. And the idea is that you'll wrap it around a tree or something similar and pull yourself out, and they work great. But not everyone has a winch. But people have started suggesting that, well, yeah, you do. Everyone's got a winch in their truck or your van or your car. I mean, you got 4 of them. If you got 4-wheel drive, you at least got 2 of them. And yeah. So the suggestion here is that your wheels are those horizontal drums and that you could wrap a rope around them and drive forward, and that will wrap the rope around your wheel and pull you out. Okay, let's take a step back. Can you do this, and will it work? Yes, and maybe. But the question you should be asking yourself is, should you do this? Okay, first off, you need the rope. You'd be better off with a strap. If you had some kind of a big flat strap, and a big flat strap, that would be best. You run the strap around your tire through the spokes of the wheel, and hopefully you have a wheel that has big ventilation holes. And you have to be very careful not to let any of the strap or rope or whatever you're using get in any kind of contact with the brakes or the brake lines or anything like that. You want it to wrap around the wheel in one section and then wrap around the tire as you try to pull forward. And this has to be done on a wheel that has power. So if you have a 2-wheel drive van and you put it on your front wheels, it's really not going to work. It has to be on one of the back wheels, or you have to be in 4-wheel drive. And then you have the issue of, you know, 4-wheel drive doesn't mean all 4 wheels go at the same time unless you have diff lockers. We're going to ignore that for now. Let's just talk about this crazy thing to begin with. And then you apply the gas very slowly, and as the wheel turns, it wraps that strap around itself, and that will pull you out. And you can see videos on YouTube of people doing this, and it works. You'll see fewer videos on YouTube of people trying this and having it destroy their vehicles. The engineering in your vehicle is not designed to put that kind of pressure on those components. The chances of you damaging your vehicle doing this is very, very high. That strap could rip your wheel off. I mean, literally it could. There's all these little arms that hold your wheel in place. It could rip them off. Less chance of that with a back wheel, but if you're in 4-wheel drive on an all-wheel drive vehicle and you try it on the front, like say a Sprinter all-wheel drive, yeah, good chance it's going to rip something off. And then the strap, as you go forward, what you're supposed to do is, as you're going forward, you're supposed to turn the wheel to have the strap come off so you can actually remove it from the tire so you can drive away without having to jack the vehicle up. As you do that, the strap comes off the wheel with some force, and where it goes is anyone's guess. It could easily hit a brake line or a sensor or, and this is the other part, a person. This isn't safe. Anybody near this whole process is putting themselves at risk. Also, the strap could break, or the whatever, however you hooked it to a tree or whatever you're using, could come loose, and it could rip off your fender. I mean, yeah, this is a very, very risky and dangerous thing. So should you do it? I think you should never try this unless it's an emergency, unless you have your 1,000 miles from help, nobody's coming to save you, and if you can't walk out of there, you've got a medical emergency, whatever the situation is, yeah, it might be okay to know that you can do this. But if you're like just kind of stuck in the mud and there's other vehicles around, and no, don't risk the damage to your vehicle and don't risk the damage to people, not to mention the poor tree. However, if you would like to learn more about this, I am not even going to link to a video about this, but you can search YouTube for such topics as self-recovery with a rope or a strap or use your wheel as a winch or anything like that. And you can see people doing this and you can see people actually getting themselves out of trouble with this. But you're not seeing the people who had bad, bad things happen to them. So it's probably a good thing to keep in the back of your mind in case you're in a total emergency, but it is definitely no replacement for having recovery boards, proper straps, a winch if you're in that kind of country where you're likely to need it, friends that you're traveling with, and some way to call for help if you actually need it. Product review. Well, now that we've talked about the fridge that everybody hates that they probably shouldn't, we're going to talk about something else that everybody hates that they probably shouldn't. If you have gone to Home Depot or Lowe's or Menards or any of those places recently, you may have seen that lumber is expensive. I mean, you know, it used to be like, oh, I'll just get a couple of 2x4s, and now you're like, holy cow, what is going on with these 2x4s? They're expensive and they're crappy. Plywood is crazy expensive. A 4x8 sheet of marine ply, say 3/4 inch, which makes a great base for the back of your van. That's what's in my my former ambulance, former van. The base of that, the way they built it, was with this giant 3/4 inch ply, marine ply, and then they built everything on that. It's very, very strong. It's $125 just for that one sheet of plywood. And you might be looking for cheaper alternatives. Well, you may find this product called hardboard. It's brown. It's basically really thick cardboard. That's really all it is. It's hard. Often it has holes in it for pegboards. A lot of inexpensive pegboards are made out of this stuff, but you can get it without the holes. This stuff really doesn't have that much to recommend it. It is no comparison to plywood. Things you can do with plywood you can't do with hardboard. It's thin, it's flimsy, it'll break, and it's not waterproof. It's slightly water resistant. Like if you spilled a Coke on it, you could probably wipe up the Coke and be fine. But if it sits in any kind of water, it's going to turn to mush and be useless. And because of that, people say, oh, don't use this in your van, it's too crappy. Now, there are definitely uses for it, though. You can put it on your walls, for example. It makes a nice thin wall covering. Let's say you have put insulation in between the ribs of the sides of your van and you want to just cover them up. This stuff makes a great way to do that. You can get a 4x8 sheet for $15 or $16, which is not bad, or even less in some cases. I think at Menards it was like $12. For a 4x8 sheet of a material that's solid, you know, you could punch your fist through it if you wanted to, but you don't want to, so that's pretty good. That is not a bad use, and because it's the same stuff they use for pegboards, as long as you get the thick stuff, there's a really thin stuff that you couldn't really do this with, you can hang stuff from it. You can actually put screws into it, But really what you're going to do is nut and bolts, some kind of hollow wall fastener type of thing maybe, and hang things from it. Not big cabinets. It's not going to hold the weight. But a picture? Sure. A hook for like hanging your coat? Yeah, you could get away with that. All I'm trying to say here is this stuff isn't useless. And what I'm using it for is something that you guys could use it for too, even just temporarily. In fact, I did this in my NV 200 when I was building it out. I made a floor out of it. Now, I am experimenting with a no-build solution for my pickup truck, which is an 8-foot bed, the full-size bed. This stuff, I opened the door, and I put it in, and I shut the door. I didn't have to cut it or anything. It just, the whole thing just slopped bink back into the back of the truck, which is why people like 8-foot bed trucks. It's just so satisfying. Yeah, you might do this once a year, but that moment, that once-a-year moment is so satisfying that you can just put this big sheet good in there and it just sits. All right, I'm getting a little too rapturous about this. But what that did was it created a nice flat floor for the back of my truck. And it's removable. And I can walk on it. And the ribs of the bed don't get in the way. And okay, sure, I might get water back there. But the water is actually going to drain through the channels under it. And all right, yeah, it's going to get damaged or whatever. But who cares? Who cares? It's $15. So what I did in the NV 200 was I made a floor out of this stuff, knowing that that was not going to be the finished floor. It was the floor I had to work on. And I spilled glue on it and paint on it and all this stuff. But it added comfort to the build process. It protected the floor of the van. And then when I was ready to put in the finished floor, I yanked it out and actually put in a piece of very thin plywood, and is what I did in the NV 200, because ceiling height was very important. I used a piece of like roof sheathing, which is probably a little too thin, but it ended up working out okay. So do not just disregard this stuff as useless, especially at a time where things like thin plywoods are so expensive. This stuff can actually be useful. Just understand what it can and can't do. It's not a substitute for any wooden thing. It is a big piece of material that's hard enough to cover up big spaces and to hold light things, and it's cheap enough to be disposable. It's also very easy to deal with. You can cut it with a circular saw. The edges will fray. You're never going to get this stuff to look good. Yes, you can paint it if you want to. But that's not its point. Another use for this, and I recommend this for anybody who has a shop or whatever, it's great for working under your van. Get a piece of 4x8 and cut it up into pieces, and then if you have to crawl under your van, put a piece of this down first. And you can lay on that. It's much, much more comfortable. Or if you want it as a sacrificial piece and you have a vehicle with dripping strips oil, slide this under there. It's just a good material to have. So I just want to stick up for the underdogs today, apparently. And hardboard, I think, is an underdog. It is a good product for what it is. The problem is when people use it for what it isn't. Tales from the road. This isn't actually my tale. It's someone else's tale, but I'm stealing it. I may not get all the details right, but it doesn't matter because the point of the story is there. So I knew a couple. They were about my age, although I heard this story maybe 25 years ago. They were like to hike, you know. They weren't avid hikers. They liked to do some day hiking, you know. And they were in Las Vegas, and they were like, okay, that's enough of the lights and the smoke and the noise and the casinos. Let's do some hiking, and tons of hiking opportunities near Las Vegas. They decided they wanted to do something a little different, and they crossed the border into Arizona, and I believe, I might be wrong about this, but I believe it was the Arizona Hot Springs Trail system they were on. And these are really easy to get to. This, you head out on the interstate, and there's a parking area, and you just park, and you can just walk down for an hour or so, and then you get to this beautiful spot where there's this place where the river opens up and forms kind of a lake, although it's still a river. It looks like a lake. And there's mountains all around, and I actually have done this hike, and I found pieces of sheep horn there. It's a fun, nice, interesting, and a cool, literally cool place to hike, because when you get to the bottom, the temperature's a lot cooler than when at the top. Now, these folks were early morning folks, so they got up at like 6 a.m., drove out there, and hit the trail at 7:30, and had a lovely time. they walked all the way down and saw these beautiful things. They spent an hour or so at the bottom, and then, you know, it was getting to be 10 o'clock, 10:30. They decided it was time to head back, and they were going to, you know, go back to town for lunch. And so they start walking and walking, and, you know, boy, it's a lot hotter now, isn't it? It's yeah, you know, it's, that's how it goes. And the sun came up in such a way that it beat down on the trail, and, yeah, sorry, this is a lot more work than getting down, that's for sure. And, you know, they're getting up, and they're getting up, and, oh, wow, all right, it's time for a rest. And they sit down and rest, and, you know, they look, and they're like, boy, we really haven't made it that far. And an hour later, they've gone some more, and they're getting more and more tired, and they're sweating, and it's just getting miserable. This pleasurable hike has turned into, like, a death march. And at this point now, things are starting to get desperate. They're actually literally having a hard time getting to the top. One of them is panting crazy and just sweating profusely. They've gone through all their water. And then the other of the couple kind of stops sweating, but also is just like, that's it. I can't go on anymore. And so it was a man and a woman, and it was the woman who couldn't make it, and the man, who was in no good shape whatsoever, actually did keep going. He made it up, and he got to the rental car, but he had to leave his wife behind. And so, you know, what do you do? He made a decision, you know, I could go for help, or I can try to solve this myself. And he chose that option, which may or may not have been the right thing to do, but he was a little clever about it. He thought about, what if I have to drag her up here, you know? And he thought about getting the floor mats out of the car and kind of putting her on the floor mats and dragging her up. But would that work? Because he barely made it himself, you know? They were actually in serious, serious trouble because it was a weekday. This trail wasn't that heavily used. This was before cell phones were ubiquitous. And his best option at that point was to wave somebody down and ask for help on the interstate. So he decided that given those options, he'd go back down and talk to her and see what she wanted to do. So he went all the way back down to where she was, which was maybe three quarters of the way up, and talked to her and basically coaxed her in little steps. Like, all right, tell you what, we know what we can do if we have to. Let's see if we can get you a little bit closer. So even 100 steps closer is going to help. And he did that, and he kept doing that over and over and over again until finally she could see the end of the trail, and that gave her the motivation to keep going and actually make it to the top. Now, these people were not athletes by any means, but they weren't, you know, horribly out of shape. You know, they walked regularly, but they didn't factor in all the circumstances. They were starting off in the morning when it was cool, going downhill in the shade because the sun hadn't fully come up yet. They did not figure that, we're going to be heading back up in the full sun where it was going to be getting close to 100 degrees. That's going to be a whole lot harder. And that's the moral of this tale here is, you can figure out that you want to go to a place, but you also have to figure out how you're going to get back. Now, hiking up mountains has this challenge, but it's reversed, right? You're doing the hard part first. Coming down is easier, although seasoned hikers will tell you that's not necessarily true. Coming down actually hurts more. It's more pressure on your knees. That aside, if you are ever going in a hiking situation where you're going down for the first part and you have to come back up, make sure you know what you're getting into. Make sure you plan for that. Make sure you have enough water. Make sure you understand how hot it's going to be. For example, for that kind of a trip, it would actually be better to start later in the day and come back up as the sun is setting and it's getting cooler, although then you have to worry about hiking in the dark and things like that. So anyway, just a story that you can learn from somebody else's mishap and their perseverance. Obviously, they did get out of there. They were able to tell me the story. And in fact, they actually are the ones who took me down this trail later on to show me how cool it was. But we did a bit more planning that time. A place to visit. So this is, or was, Jaws Summer. Yes, it's been 50 years since the movie Jaws came out and decimated shark populations all around the world. And yes, I know that the word decimated actually means reduce by 1/10 and does not apply in this case, but its popular usage is it caused mass chaos, and that's exactly what happened. Shark populations have dwindled dramatically since Jaws came out because Jaws scared everybody about sharks. And yeah, sure, sharks can be dangerous. There's shark attacks every year. We get that. But if you've looked at the stats at all, bees, dogs, coconuts, and cows are all much more dangerous than sharks. And I haven't seen anyone going out hunting coconuts recently. All that said, there's a little bit of a creepy aspect to Jaws. Now, Jaws, the movie, was made by Steven Spielberg. Everybody knows this, I think. But where did he get the idea? Well, he got it from a book called, Jaws. And that book was written by a man named Peter Benchley. So where did Peter Benchley get the idea? I mean, it's not that complicated of an idea. There's a monster. It eats people. People go hunt it and kill it. I mean, you can go all the way back to Beowulf for that. No, though. This is based on a true story? Yeah, Jaws is based on a true story. That's true. And you can go visit the place where the true story happened. Let me explain. There's one big difference between the true story and the fictional story, and it's not the one you're thinking. So in 1916, in New Jersey, not too far from Amity, or Martha's Vineyard, where the movie was filmed, in Mattawan, New Jersey, there was a shark attack. So the full story is, on July 12, 1916, six boys are swimming off of a dock in a freshwater creek in Mattawan. And they're teenagers, you know, one kid's 12, and that's Lester Stillwell, and he's attacked by the shark, and they're all confused, like, what's going on? All the kids rush out of the water, but after the shark is done, Lester's body is still in the water, and a gentleman on the shore by the name of Stanley Fisher sees this, and he's like, this is horrible, I better go get that body. So he goes into the water to get the body, not realizing that the shark is still feeding on the body, and the shark kills him too. Now he makes it to shore, but he dies of his wounds. And this shocked the community. And you remember the scene where everyone's hunting the shark and all these guys come out in their boats and they've got all this crazy equipment and stuff? Yeah, that happened. They did that looking for the shark. Now, this was a freshwater creek over a mile from the ocean, but they figured the shark wasn't in the creek anymore. They figured the shark had gone back to the ocean. And out in Raritan Bay, which is the border of New York and New Jersey, they did catch a big shark. It was 8 feet long and weighed 300 pounds. And when they took the shark ashore and cut it open, again, remember the movie, they found 15 pounds of human flesh in the shark. This shark had eaten people, and it probably was the shark that was in the freshwater creek. So if you remember in the movie, there's a scene where the shark is in what they call the pond. You know, it was the protected area. And there's a guy in a rowboat. We famously see his leg, specifically, at one scene. Yeah, that all kind of, sort of, really happened. Now, there wasn't this big shark out there killing dozens of people, you know, and it wasn't 35 feet long or anything like that. But yeah, this was a bull shark, not a great white like in the movie. And bull sharks have been known to swim up in freshwater streams. And there's been rumors of bull sharks in Lake Michigan. They are not true. You can find sites that say, oh, a bull shark was caught in Lake Michigan in the 1950s. It's not true. Anything that is even close to that being true is because some prankster brought a dead shark and threw it in the lake. That has happened. And yes, there have been some alligators, and it's the same thing. The alligators didn't swim up there. People let them go. I mean, heck, there was an alligator on our subway system, and there was one at the airport. We have weird animal stuff here in Chicago, but no sharks. No sharks. Anyway, why am I bringing this up in a place to visit? Well, you can visit the spot where this actually happened. And there's a memorial there that explains the story. And what else is there, or at least it was. Now, I haven't visited this spot, but if you look at pictures of this place, there's a very creative bit of graffiti. There is a bridge that goes over the river near where the event happened. And the way they built the bridge, it doesn't, like, span over the river. It kind of covers two big culverts, and the river goes through the culverts under the bridge. And the culverts are an arch shape, half of an oval that comes out of the water. And somebody said, that looks like a shark's mouth. And they painted all around it to make it look like this giant shark is there, and it's just a little creepy. But anyway, hey, it's Jaws summer, and if you want to visit a little bit of history, don't go to Martha's Vineyard for the fake stuff. Go to Matawan, New Jersey for the real stuff. And I will have a link from Atlas Obscura that explains the whole thing in the show notes. Resource recommendation. So I drive a lot. You guys drive a lot, probably. And yes, there's podcasts and music. And there's all kinds of stuff to listen to while you're driving. But I've been driving a lot alone lately. And podcasts, sometimes I have to turn them off because they put me to sleep. And that's just me. It's not because of the podcast. I mean, people have told me that this podcast puts them to sleep. And I'm like, excellent. I'm glad I'm performing a public service. That isn't what I'm talking about. It's just the act of listening for that long can make it difficult for me to stay awake. So I look for other strategies. And I've been interested in AI recently, not only generative AI, which is making things for you, but also conversational AI, where you're actually having a conversation with this program like it's a person. Now, people have said, oh, you're just being fooled by fancy autocorrect and next token, blah. I get it. I understand how it works, I mean, to some level. And I know I'm not talking to a real person. I know this thing isn't really intelligent. It doesn't matter. What it's doing is keeping me awake while I'm driving. And I found this fun little game I play with AI that you might enjoy too. So all you need to do this is some sort of AI program, whether it's Copilot or ChatGPT or Claude. I've done it with all three of those. I assume it would work with Gemini or Perplexity or whatever else there is out there. All these AI programs know all classical fiction. Like, they will know the works of Mark Twain and Mary Shelley. They will know Star Wars. They will know all the stuff that kind of everybody knows. And the stuff that's public domain, they will know in depth. I mean, you can ask it questions about Beowulf, and it will know every last thing about Beowulf because it's all in its memory. But I had this thought that, well, this thing knows everything about, say, Tom Sawyer, you know, the book Tom Sawyer. You can ask it questions, you know, who was Tom Sawyer's nemesis and all this. But then I thought, what if I could ask it to be Tom Sawyer? Like, what if you, Mr. AI or Ms. AI, depending on how you set it up, are Tom Sawyer and we can have a conversation? I was like, how cool is that? I can have a conversation with Tom Sawyer, if it works. And so I tried it out with a number of characters. I tried it out with Frankenstein's monster, and from the novel, not the movies, very different character. Frankenstein's monster in the novels was very intelligent, very well-educated. Had a really interesting conversation with him. Tried it out with Hazel, the rabbit from Watership Down, who wasn't as interesting as I'd hoped. Kind of a dull character, actually, in the end. And then I had a conversation with Bartleby the Scrivener. And if you know anything about Bartleby the Scrivener, you can imagine how that went. I'll leave that for you to search on if you don't know what I'm talking about. And you know what? It was great fun, and it made the time fly. And it actually, honestly, made me laugh many, many times. Now, to be clear here, we're not talking about the holodeck. You are not recreating fantasies here. The AI doesn't know any more than what's in the book, and it can extrapolate some things, but you're not going to be able to, like, figure out how a tertiary character thought about things very much. You know, if the character is not very well fleshed out, AI doesn't have much to work with, it's not going to give you much. You want to pick a rich character. So I thought I would share with you some of this stuff I've done, and then you can see if you think this is fun or not. So here you go. And to be clear here, I'm using a free version of Copilot, which is at bing.com/copilot. And it's set to a female voice. I don't think I chose that. I think it's just what it chose. But notice how it speaks depending on who the character is. Okay, I would like you to assume the role of Tom Sawyer. Can you do that?
Well, of course. I can do that. Just imagine we're getting up to all sorts of mischief. What kind of adventure are we embarking on today?
Well, I don't know. You seem to be the leader of the group.
Well, shucks. If I'm leading, let's gather the gang and head down to the river. We could build a raft or maybe find a cave to explore. You up for an adventure?
Well, I'm always up for an adventure, but isn't the river dangerous?
Ah, danger's just part of the fun, ain't it? Besides, with a trusty crew like us, there's nothing we can't handle. Let's make a pact to stick together, no matter what we find. What do you say?
Okay, that sounds good. What are we going to do to seal that pact?
Well now, we gotta make it official-like. How about we each find something special, a little trinket, and bury it under the old oak tree as our secret sign? That way, we'll always know we're bound by adventure. You got something in mind?
Yep, but I guess we should, you know, carve our initials into that tree or something.
Why, that's a mighty fine idea. Let's carve our initials right into the trunk so it's plain for all to see. That way, we'll leave our mark and seal our pact, just like true adventurers.
Thank you very much. I would like you to become a different character. Can you become Sam Spade?
Sure thing, kid. Let's walk those mean streets and I'll show you how a real detective handles business. Got a case for me?
I do. I have somebody who's gone missing. They never came home from work. I don't know where they went, but I got a strange phone call last night.
Sounds like a real caper. Give me the details on this missing person and that strange call. We'll follow the clues and see where they lead. Stick with me. We'll crack this case wide open. Smart move bringing this to me.
Okay, let's have you try a new character. Now I would like you to be Willy Wonka.
Absolutely. Let's dive into this whimsical world together. So, what delightful ideas are swirling in your mind today?
Mr. Wonka, I am curious if the golden color of the chocolate affects the flavor at all.
Ah, my curious friend. The golden color of chocolate adds a touch of magic, but it doesn't change the flavor. It's the rich cocoa and secret ingredients that create the marvelous taste. Would you like to step into this world of wonder and discover more magical secrets?
Are you inviting me into your factory?
Why, of course. Step inside the factory where the chocolate rivers flow and the candies are beyond your wildest dreams. What delicious adventure shall we embark on first?
What's at the bottom of the river?
That's the secret, isn't it? Beneath the surface of the chocolate river flows a cascade of dreams, creativity, and perhaps a few surprises waiting to be discovered. Shall we find out together what's hidden below?
Yes. Do you have a submarine?
A submarine, you say? Why, yes, we do have one. Crafted from the finest candy and adorned with chocolatey delights. It's the perfect vessel for exploring the sweet mysteries below. Shall we embark on this delicious underwater adventure?
Okay, let's go.
Fantastic. Just imagine the adventure waiting for us. Our candy-coated submarine is ready to dive into the chocolate river. Hold on tight and let's explore the sweet mysteries beneath the surface. We're embarking on a delicious journey. As we dive into the chocolate river, keep your eyes open for the wonders beneath the surface. We're surrounded by a world of swirling sweetness. Look around. Chocolate stalactites hang from the ceiling, and glistening caramel currents guide our way. What's that over there? Glimmers of candy-coated treasures await us.
Did I just see a fish swim by?
Not just any fish. That's a gummy fish. It seems our chocolate river is teeming with these sweet swimmers. They're playful guides, leading us to even more delectable discoveries.
Now, to be clear here, this is a fantasy role-playing environment, and your participation is a big part of this. The questions you ask obviously lead the story, and how good the story is actually up to you. You have to ask stories that help the AI create the illusion that you're actually talking to this fictional character. This might be the stupidest thing you've ever heard of, or this might be kind of cool. For me, I find it useful every once in a while I'm driving and I just want to have some distraction for a while. Now, you're worried about me using the phone while I'm driving? Excellent. I appreciate that. I understand. This is completely hands-free. It is no more distracting than talking with a passenger in the car, or it's probably less distracting than talking on the phone with somebody. You have to worry about sound because it does glitch. It tends to hear itself and then stop talking. You have to worry about air conditioning blowing on the microphones, things like that. But ChatGPT and Copilot, you don't have to touch any buttons at all. Claude does require you to touch a single button that I find is not that distracting. The way I do it, it's mindless. So anyway, I just want to show this to you. Whether you use it or not, it's up to you. Whether your creativity is up to the challenge is completely something that you have to decide to test yourself. I like it, you might not, and that's okay. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to Built to Go. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And yes, we did skip the news this week because I needed to skip the news this week. Until next time, remember the words of M.A. Calloway, who said, "Sometimes the only way to keep moving is to make your world small enough to carry."